On Tech News Today, the terrorists win. Hollywood caves in the face of threats from the Sony hackers. BlackBerry goes back to the future with their new retro phone, and Amazon decided that same-day delivery just isn't fast enough. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, December 18th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Braintree. If you're a developer or manager of a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out Braintree. Braintree's new V.0 SDK makes it easy to support multiple mobile payment types with one simple integration. To learn more and to try out their sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com/twit. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll have many more happy holidays as you grow and protect your wealth with this award-winning financial app. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who reported. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. Good morning to you, Jason Cleanthes.
Morning, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. We got one more day before the big Twit shutdown and holiday and all that kind of stuff. And it's going to be sad to go a week without doing this show, but it's also going to be nice to have some time off. I'm looking forward to it to a certain extent. I'm also going to kind of dreading it. Just love this show. Our co-anchor today is the one and only Lance Ulanoff. How you doing, Lance?
I'm good.
Now, you and I long ago, it is an incestuous business. You and I long ago used to work together. And and I think that I know you well enough to know that you are a social media maniac. And you wrote a piece recently that was really cool that talked about the possibility of taking a vacation from social media. So tell us, Lance, is it possible? Can it be done?
I honestly don't know. I'm about to embark on a vacation starting next week. And it occurred to me that as much as I love Twitter, I love all of it. I love Vining. I love Instagram. There were times where it almost felt like a job or a chore because I have this anxiety about not posting. And that made me realize that maybe it was time for a break, just a little break, not a big break. And I realized I had this perfect window of time, the time starting next week right up until CES when I'm going to turn it all back on and go crazy. Because if you ever follow me during that period of time, I'm doing at least twice as much social media posting as I do on any given day when I'm walking the show floor. But if I'm going to do that effectively, I think I need a break. However, here's the reality. I'll tell you the truth. I'm terrified. Since I wrote that post, I can't stop thinking about it. I can't stop imagining what it's going to be like. My wife is laughing because she knows what I'm like. She's going to join me. She's going to take a break from Facebook. We're trying to see if we can convince our kids, which I think is going to be tough. They're teenagers, because it's going to be difficult. If one of us slips, all of us slip. And you well know as well as I do, Mike, that it's going to be difficult to not look and see it anywhere. I'm going to have my phone with me, right? So my phone is all these notifications. What if I want to check email? So I'm like, well, maybe I should take a break from email too. What if I'm watching the news and something happens? There are going to be initially in the beginning of this thing some sleepless nights.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. And, you know, I have sort of a vague and unsubstantiated theory about all this, partly that, you know, we're talking before the show started that it's genuinely addicting, but why? Why is it addicting? My theory is that it's sort of you form the psychological equivalent of a phantom limb. Your identity is associated with being not just in your, you know, inhabiting your own mind and your own body, but also inhabiting the social media space that we live in. And the fear is, I think, that when we withdraw from that, we feel like we kind of, to a certain extent, cease to exist, or at least part of us ceases to exist, right? And all these conversations continue without us, and we're, you know, you get used to it, you know, you get used to being out there.
I so wish you guys had special effects, because it would be wonderful if during the course of this interview, I literally start to disappear. Can you imagine? Because that is exactly what I fear. This is a part of my identity. I obviously existed before social media, but it is just this habit that I engage with throughout the day. From the moment I wake up until the moment I go to sleep, who am I if I am not talking to social media, if I am not engaging? I've actually worked really hard at building an audience. I'm not even the worst of them. You know, I know there are people who are doing a lot more than me, and yet I know that I do a lot. So I hope I don't cease to exist. I hope that I am not like walking around CES like the Invisible Man, a suit but no head and no hands. You know, we'll see. I may keep a diary and then publish it after the fact.
On social media.
Of course. So people can know just what it was like.
Well, Lance Yulinoff, ladies and gentlemen, taking a vacation from social media so you don't have to. Tell us what it's like when you get back. I can't wait to hear, and I hope you make it back in one piece. We're going to miss you. All right, well, let's jump into the news. Hollywood is freaking out over threats by the group claiming to have hacked Sony Pictures. Sony itself has canceled the release of the Seth Rogen and James Franco comedy, The Interview, after the GOP hacker group threatened another 9/11 if they were to release the movie. And New Regency has preemptively canceled a movie starring Steve Carell that was set in North Korea. The thriller was scheduled to start production in March. Not everyone in the movie business is caving, though. Actor Ben Stiller tweeted yesterday that it's really hard to believe this is the response to a threat to freedom of expression here in America. Talk show host Jimmy Kimmel called the cancellations an un-American act of cowardice that validates terrorist actions and sets a terrifying precedent. Steve Carell himself tweeted that it's a sad day for creative expression. The hashtag Fear Eats the Soul tracks criticism on Twitter of Hollywood's capitulation and is strongly trending now. Multiple tech journalists and pundits are calling for the immediate release of The Interview to the torrent sites, which I think is a great idea. And the Alamo Drafthouse Movie Theater in Dallas, Texas plans to show Team America, World Police for free on December 27th in place of the now canceled screening of The Interview. Team America was a mocking comedy set in North Korea produced a few years ago by the makers of South Park and acted entirely by puppets. Lance Yulinoff, this is just a terrible turn of events, I think. I mean, it's one thing for Sony Pictures, which, first of all, may have some responsibility in all this by having weak security. We don't know the details exactly, so we can't exactly accuse them. There are some experts, including in the FBI, who say that almost any company would have been defenseless against this type of attack, but we still don't know. And now they're, you know, we understand to a certain extent they're on the ropes, and for them to cancel the very picture that was the target of this whole hack is something like maybe they can be forgiven, maybe they can't. But the preemptive cancellation of a movie set in North Korea is an awful precedent as well. And I just think it's absolutely the wrong response. But of course, that's easy for me to say.
Yeah, and you know, I think Sony started this by giving the distributors an out. They said, look, if you don't want to show it because you're worried, don't. And you know, as I said in my post, 9/11 is such a trigger for the American public that, you know, for them, the distributors, the movie distributors, the theater owners immediately validated the threat. And then Sony completely validated it by canceling the release. I mean, I have been trying to wrap my mind around this. And, you know, what I keep thinking is that, and very honestly, I did not believe this would happen. I was like, well, look, it's a threat by people who don't have this capability. I was wrong that they would in fact act on it, that they would Sony and the movie theaters would act as if it was a real threat. And what they've done is given these hackers real power they've never had before. Nothing quite like this, because cyber hackers, right, where do they live? Behind their computer, at their desk, somewhere that you can't find them. They have now been equated in a very real sense with actual terrorists. It blows my mind because I don't know how we go back from this. I really don't. And I feel for – I'll be honest. I felt for Sony in this situation. But, yeah, I believe that their security wasn't great inside their network. How the hack happened, how they first got in, I don't know. Social engineering, whatever. But inside their own network, no encryption, passwords available, all sorts of stuff. Other people probably would have the same problem. So, yeah, there's that. But – they've just been knocked around for well over a week now. And I just thought this would be an opportunity to stand up and say, look, we've had enough. our movie's coming out because you guys are ridiculous. Yeah, you've hurt us at a business level, but this is our movie. This is our creative product. We're going to do it. But instead, they circled the wagons in such a way that they shut out the rest of the world. They really I think it is terribly unfortunate. And what happens next after this, I really don't know.
Well, in a related story, North Korea was behind the attack on Sony Pictures last month, according to a senior unnamed White House official, or actually several of them. The administration is still on the fence about whether to publicly blame North Korea for the attack. And this is where it really gets interesting from a policy point of view, Lance. This has been called an act of terrorism. It appears to be an act of terrorism. They're trying to scare people and scare companies into changing their behavior. That's the definition of terrorism. And the White House says that it's North Korea. So now if that's all true, then North Korea is officially engaging in terrorism against Americans and American companies. What is the response against an Orwellian dictatorship that's probably nuclear powered and that it has nothing to lose, really? And which is fear, that the biggest fear of North Korea, by the way, is that the regime will collapse suddenly, because if that happens, the starving masses from North Korea come rushing to South Korea and they can't handle that. And so it's really a problem for the administration. They're going to be getting pressure from the Republicans to take a strong, a response to this act of terrorism, if it is in fact North Korea. And so it's really quite a response. But I'm curious, Lance, as a nation, what do you think the president should do? What do you think the government should do? And what do you think the citizens should do in the face of this attack?
Well, I mean, I'm still not ready to equate this with a terrorist attack. This is the cyber hack. Our response, the Sony response, the theater response, was outsized to what happened. You know, it's very damaging for the business, but it's not damaging to us as a people yet. But I think that we have to tread carefully. Here's the thing. There's a question about whether or not it's North Korea and whether or not the U.S. saying it is, the government saying it is, in some way benefits the administration, makes things easier. But there's another school of thought that says, you know, that the government's information about where this came from could be coming from their best source available, which would be the NSA, the National Security Administration, that has the tools to actually figure it out. And if they're saying that, then it's possible it came from North Korea. But actually, I should say it came maybe from within North Korea. There is a monumental difference there between something that was sanctioned by the North Korean government and something that came from within North Korea by hackers who wanted to really have a good time and, you know, don't like America anyway. I think that there are too many variables for the U.S. to take, Obama to take aggressive action, and I don't think he will. Now, I've been wrong about everything in this story, so who the heck knows? But I hope that sort of steadier hands guide the way here, and that we just figure out how to protect ourselves and also think about releasing that movie.
Meanwhile, if the hackers really intended to sort of suppress this movie and suppress the sort of the messages inside this ridiculous comedy, which is, you know, they go into detail about all the kinds of ridiculous things that aren't really true about North Korean government. The stuff that is true is bad enough, to be sure, but they exaggerate it just to show what a horrible dictatorship it is. They failed because this is essentially something called the Streisand effect. And if you're not familiar with that phrase, the Streisand effect originated with years ago. There was a project called the California Coastal Records Project that wants to take pictures of the California coastline, all of it, from the top to the bottom of the state, along the beach, and do it frequently to show changes that are happening and maybe threatening the ecosystem and access and so on of the California coastline. And Barbara Streisand has a house in Malibu right there on the beach, and she complained to the California Coastal Project that her house was visible. You could see her lounge chairs on the deck of her Malibu house and so on. And she didn't want people looking at her house, but nobody thought to look at her house until she complained about it loudly, and then all of a sudden everybody was looking at Barbara Streisand's house. That's exactly what's happening here. They're bringing so much attention to this movie that they're doing the opposite of suppressing it. They're turning a two-bit, third-rate comedy that would have been totally forgettable, and they're making it a historic piece, a document. in the history of cyber attacking and international relations.
You know what? I'm 100% behind that. Let's turn it. Let's take that power away from them. Let's turn the interview into the biggest movie of the year. Release it on every screen available. Every American go to see it with a big finger to North Korea. And then let's give it Best Picture. Let's just push it all the way through. I mean, I really think that we have gone in the opposite of direction of what we should have done here. We're not going to get pushed around by a bunch of idiots in some hotel room writing code. I mean, that's what we've just allowed to happen here. We need to turn it around, and we need to get behind this second-rate film.
And if you work for Sony Pictures, you know, leaking the interview is the best revenge. You heard it here first. Well, in just a second, we're going to get into some other news, including some happy news coming from BlackBerry. I think it's happy news. But first, I want to tell you about Braintree. If you've got a mobile app and you need to monetize by adding a payment system, you can't do better than Braintree. They have the very, very best mobile apps integration that you can possibly get. They support Apple Pay, PayPal, Bitcoin, Venmo, all the major credit and debit cards, and 130 global currencies. It's super, super easy to integrate Braintree. It takes less than 10 minutes to integrate because it's less than 10 lines of code, very slim. You can integrate it just so quickly. Give them a call and they'll even handle the integration for you and walk you through it step by step if you're not sure how to do it. And the Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. It's available. Their SDK is available in Python, Ruby, and Java. They have really elegant code. You've got to check it out. And of course, the most important thing, especially after the story we're just talking about, is that it's the most secure way to have payments in your app. The reason is tokenized payments. You have to have tokenized payments if you want real security. It just encrypts the data. It goes right past the merchant and straight into the financial system. And so there's no chance of a, you know, target-like hack for your users to be victimized by. So if you're searching for the right payments platform, check out Braintree V.0 SDK today at braintreepayments.com/twit. You can review their documentation, play around in their sandbox. And after you integrate Braintree, here's a bonus. The first $50,000 in transactions are fee-free. That's braintreepayments.com/twit. We thank them for their support of Tech News Today. BlackBerry today announced their BlackBerry Classic, a throwback to the BlackBerries of yesteryear. As you might expect, it has a physical keyboard and navigation keys, but also a 720 by 720 pixel 3.5-inch touchscreen. Phil Goldstein is the editor of Fierce Wireless and joins us now to talk about the BlackBerry Classic. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm doing all right. Thanks, Mike. How are you?
Great. Thank you for joining us. Now, one strange thing about this release is that it's already available, is it not, unlocked on Amazon and BlackBerry.com, but Verizon and AT&T haven't even revealed ship dates or prices. Do you know what they're waiting for?
I'm not sure. I think that, you know, I was at the event yesterday in New York City where BlackBerry unveiled this, and they said that Verizon and AT&T were going to be releasing more details about their pricing and about their release dates for the phone after Christmas. I'm not exactly sure what's behind the kind of delay in getting the carrier pricing and the carrier information. I think it's a good sign for BlackBerry that they got Verizon to sign on, because with their last phone, the Passport, they only got AT&T to sign on in terms of U.S. carrier support. So, you know, it's a little bit of progress for a company that needs, you know, all the help it can get.
So what about... I'm curious about the market for phones with keyboards, since you know, my phone of choice, you know, an iPhone 6. I haven't used a phone with a keyboard in ages.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that they're very clearly positioning the Classic for folks who have kept their BlackBerries, for folks who love the BlackBerry Bold of, you know, say 2011. And unfortunately for BlackBerry, there are fewer of those kinds of customers now than there were in 2011, much fewer. I think that according to research firm Gartner, in the third quarter of 2014, BlackBerry's global market share for smartphones was just 0.8%, which was down from 1.8% in the year-ago period. So they're clearly targeting this at BlackBerry diehards, BlackBerry loyalists, and prosumers who really are more interested in email, in productivity, than anything else. This is not a phone that's designed for people who want to watch lots of videos or play lots of games on their phone.
So Obama's definitely a possible client here, right?
Yeah, I mean, why not? I think that, you know, if you care about those kinds of things, about productivity, about corporate or secure email, this is a great phone. I got a chance to play with it a little bit yesterday. The keyboard is great. It's very accurate and responsive, and you can really kind of bang out a lengthy email on it in short order. You know, the question, I think, from a device's perspective for BlackBerry at this point is, how large is their market? How aggressive are they going to be in promoting this? You know, they talked about U.S. and Canadian carrier partners yesterday, but I was told that this is going to be a global launch, and that they're going to target this at other markets like Europe and Latin America. So they clearly want to, you know, make a big push with this. It's just a question of how large their addressable market is at this point. And John Chen, the CEO of BlackBerry, basically said, you know, he was asked by Dan Seifert from The Verge, you know, why are you not just shipping this directly to enterprises? Why are you, you know, targeting this at all at the consumer market? And John Chen said, well, basically, you know, we have to make decisions, and I've had to make decisions about which markets to go after. And he said the enterprise is definitely our core market, but we're also going after prosumers. So it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how they market this phone.
My biggest concern is whether Kim Kardashian will like it. She tends to hoard the old ones. She buys old BlackBerries because she loves them so much, and she's scared to death that she's not going to be able to get them in the future. So she has a bunch of them. Now, BlackBerry is emphasizing security with their secure productivity suite. Are you impressed with this bundle? Is this something, do you think, is going to make people more inclined to buy the phone?
Well, I think that those kinds of value-added services, things like VPN authentication and encrypted BBM messages, those are things that are targeted really at the enterprises and you know, the companies that are buying the BES 12, the BlackBerry Enterprise service, from BlackBerry for the server side. You know, then BlackBerry says to them, well, you know, you can give this bundle of services to all of your users for $6 a month. Per user. And, you know, they're clearly looking to get more kind of ancillary revenue that way. I don't know, you know, how appealing that is going to be. I mean, for certain regulated industries like the financial services industry, government users, perhaps even folks in healthcare, those kinds of things, you know, do make a difference and probably are, you know, valuable. But I'm not sure, you know, that those kinds of bundled value-added services that cost, you know, $6 or $12 a month, it's 12 if you're somebody who doesn't already have BES. I don't know if those things are going to be what saves BlackBerry. They talked about how at CES they're going to reveal more details about this Internet of Things platform that they've been working on, and that, I think, actually holds more potential for them long-term because they own this software subsidiary called QNX that powers connected cars and all kinds of connected machines. And that really, you know, could be the growth engine for them going forward. The devices business is a, you know, shadow of what it once was. And, you know, John Chen said, you know, we don't think of devices anymore as just phones. And, you know, it's a good thing because their phone business is not that, you know, strong. But I do think that this Internet of Things platform holds potential for them.
And Ford, which has been long associated with innovation in terms of the technology and the dashboard, just dumped Microsoft and embraced BlackBerry's QNX. And
that's
so
correct.
That's a good sign for BlackBerry, to be sure. Phil Goldstein is at FierceWireless.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Fierce Wireless. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Phil.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is suing Sprint for cramming, which is the practice of allowing other companies to add fees to customer bills that the customers didn't necessarily authorize. The lawsuit claims Sprint charged hundreds of millions of dollars in cramming charges and took a 40% cut. The suit also alleges that Sprint didn't help customers who complained. Maggie Reardon is a reporter for CNET and joins us now.
Hi.
How are you doing, Maggie?
I'm doing well.
Great. Now, what is this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? I'm not familiar with that.
Well, you know, I wasn't either until I heard about this lawsuit. So they're a new agency that was started in 2010 as part of the Dodd-Frank legislation that came as a result of basically our whole financial system melting down. So this is another agency that is tasked specifically with protecting customers who are financial service customers. So I guess because there are payments processed over mobile phones, they say they have jurisdiction over things like mobile carriers who process payments.
Maggie, has this agency ever sued another company for cramming?
Not that I'm aware of. This is the first time, and it's kind of interesting that they're getting involved in this, since usually it's the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission that have been coming down hard on cramming. So this seems like sort of a new angle for these guys, but they say that they are working with both the FTC and the FCC.
The AT&T agreed to pay $105 million to settle cramming charges, and T-Mobile's under investigation. So there's a lot of this going on, and according to U.S. government statistics, only 1 in 20 people, customers, realize that they've been hit by cramming. Why is this so hard for people to detect? Isn't it right there on their bill?
Yeah, but who looks at your bill? I mean, after a while, you should look at your bill. But I'll say that I've fallen victim to this myself, not cramming per se, but the fact that I don't look at every bill. I mean, now that you have things set up to pay automatically, a lot of times, and there are so many line items on your bill that it's hard to figure out what you're being charged for. So a lot of times this went unnoticed. And the fees were pretty small, so people didn't really notice what they were.
Can you give us an example of one of, like, what would such a fee look like? I mean, would you recognize it? Is it always a specific company, or is it just general, you know, a variety of companies they throw into the mix?
I think it was a little hard to recognize what it was. And again, I think some of these charges were pretty small. And usually they came up as a result of somebody clicking on a link for a ringtone or for one of those sort of paid text messaging type things. And I think sometimes people didn't realize that they were actually signing up for some sort of service. And so then the bill kept reoccurring, or the charge kept reoccurring on their bill.
Well, let it be a lesson to all of us. Check your bill. There looks like all of the major carriers have done this. And who knows, they may do it in the future. It's always a good idea to check those bills very carefully. Maggie Reardon is at CNET.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Maggie_Reardon. Thanks for joining us, Maggie.
Thanks for having me.
All right. ICANN, which is responsible for the Internet's domain name system, says they were hacked in November after a spear phishing attack. The breach compromised the email credentials of several ICANN staff members, and these credentials were used to gain unauthorized access to the files in ICANN's centralized zone data system, which stores information about registered top-level domain holders. This information includes their names, postal addresses, emails, phone numbers, usernames, and encrypted passwords. The perpetrator of the hack is unknown, and Lance Ulanoff, I don't want to throw out a general accusation, but this sounds kind of like China. They have a tendency, lately we've been reporting a lot of stories about hacks coming out of China where they're going after people. They attacked several government databases where they wanted the personal information, the addresses, the phone numbers, and so on, of people who worked for various government agencies. And this is another one where they're going after the database that houses people. Now, that could be a coincidence. Sometimes hackers gain access to whatever it is that they can gain access to, whatever's easiest to breach. But sometimes they're really targeting certain types of information. We don't know anything about this other than the fact that it's a very disturbing that ICANN itself is being hacked here.
So I think that this is the same story over and over again. You know, when they say spear phishing, that is really just social engineering. And it could be China, it could be anyone. Those attacks take some sophistication, but they don't take as much technology as you would think, because they really rely on people believing that you are somebody you are not, that you represent the bank or you represent an official entity. You know, when you sign up for a domain, it's very interesting, because in real life, you often get letters from third-party agencies saying, hey, your domain's about to be up, you better re-up again, except it's not from the agency that manages your domain. It's from another company that's trying to get you to switch, and they make it seem super official. So it's not a big surprise this has happened. And if it's China, you know, why not use spear phishing or social engineering? Because it's the easiest attack available.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, first Amazon nailed overnight delivery, then it pioneered same-day delivery, and now Amazon is delivering packages to New York City residents in less than an hour. The new service is called Prime Now, and it costs $7.99 for each delivery. The service, of course, is for Prime members only. And the delivery set is for a set list of some tens of thousands of daily essentials like packaged foods, soap, paper towels, toys, and batteries. The service is available in the borough of Manhattan only, and it starts at 6 a.m. and runs until midnight 7 days a week. This is astounding. Sunday morning at 6 a.m., you need batteries. You can have them in an hour brought to your door. This is really amazing, Lance. Do you live in New York City, or do you live near New York City?
Outside of New York City.
Okay, so, you know, these Manhattan residents have it made. You can already get almost anything delivered if you live in Manhattan, especially food. And now they have batteries and toys. You know, it's really incredible. And, you know, prices they're charging here, $7.99, it's hard to imagine that they could make it worthwhile. But I guess they know what they're doing.
There was an article that talked about all the bad ideas from the dot-com bust becoming good ideas now, like all these like little delivery systems, you know, because there were a bunch of them that tried this and totally failed. But every idea now seems to be working, and people are lazy.
Yep.
They want stuff now. They're very used to getting meals delivered from all the local eateries, you know, thanks to places like, you know, online services like Seamless, because they can do it all through their phone. So this stuff can work now, really work.
In just a sec, we've got some updates for you, including some very interesting updates. But first, I want to tell you about Personal Capital. Personal Capital is going to help you get your financial house in order. And they do a wonderful thing, a miracle, if you will. They take all your financial information that's in this account and that account and with this institution and that institution, and it brings it all together so you can get an intuitive view of your money, so you can see what's actually happening with your money. What's growing? What's shrinking? What's working? What isn't working? And they'll also save you from some unnecessary fees that you may be getting. And it's already helping more than 700,000 people just like you manage and grow your wealth. So you've got to try Personal Capital. Here's the math. It's free and it will save you money. So there's literally no reason to not use Personal Capital. They also have some really cool apps. They have mobile apps, and they even have a Google Android Wear app on your watch. So when you are about to incur unnecessary fees, your wrist will buzz and it will tell you what to do in order to avoid those fees. It's really fantastic. Take control of your financial future and make a New Year's resolution to get your financial house in order. Set up your free account. Go to personalcapital.com/TNT. Personal Capital is free, and it's a smart way to grow your money. And we thank Personal Capital for their support of Tech News Today. Nokia is thinking about making wearable computing devices, according to the German magazine Manager magazine. The publication also reported that Nokia Networks has started new talks with the French telecom equipment company Alcatel-Lucent about a possible merger. The companies have been holding on-again, off-again talks for 5 years. Lance, how good of an idea is it for Nokia to make wearable devices? I think it's fantastic, and I think they should also make sort of home automation and Internet of Things devices as well. I think they're only prohibited from making phones. But what do you think about Nokia as a wearable computing company?
First, by making it clear who they really are, because it's going to be confusing for people for a while, since this is not the Nokia that's the unit that became part of Microsoft. Everybody's getting into wearables. There's a huge, wide-open market because it's not a settled market. There's no leaders, really, in the wearable space. There's so many options because it's a fashion option. So, yeah, please do so. And come out with something that looks great and feels great. You know, I'll give you an example. So Microsoft came out with the Band, right? Which works really well. It's very cool, but doesn't feel so good to wear. And this is a pretty common problem. So wouldn't it be great if Nokia, of all people, showed up with something that hits the wearable market right on the mark, just gets it perfect?
That would be fantastic. And it'd be nice to have something beyond just, you know, wristwatches. I don't think we have a good glasses alternative yet. We have a lot of people trying, and all of them are unacceptable for prime time. Let's face it. There's a world of possible wearable devices that could exist. And Nokia, of course, is a very innovative company. They have some great technology. They have the near mapping service, which could be integrated with a wearable device. That could be cool. So, yeah, I'm rooting for them, and I hope that they come out with something cool. Well, Uber plans to use better technology as a way to screen drivers. The company is now researching the use of biometrics and voice verification to identify prospective drivers in the wake of the company's ban in New Delhi, which happened after a driver allegedly raped a passenger. They're also considering the use of lie detector tests for new drivers. The problem they're trying to solve is that extensive background checks used in the United States don't work in some countries where records may not be electronic or may not exist, or where a bribe can expunge someone's criminal record. Of course, U.S. background checks are no guarantee either. A Boston Uber driver yesterday was charged with raping a female passenger in exactly the same way as the accused Indian driver. We told you on a previous episode about Apple's holiday product Red campaign. In that initiative, Apple donated part of its Black Friday and Cyber Monday sales revenue and also partnered with software developers to donate some of their app revenue to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS in Africa. In an internal email obtained by Recode, Apple CEO Tim Cook told employees that the campaign raised more than $20 million. Lance Ulanoff, do you think it's a new Apple? Do you think that the post-Steve Jobs and the Tim Cook version of Apple is going to be warmer and fuzzier and more prone to this kind of philanthropic enterprise?
Well, Stefan, I mean, it certainly was not something that Steve Jobs was all that comfortable doing, at least, doing in public. And, Tim Cook has said that, always said that he would sort of maintain the ethos of the company, but also go his own way. And I think this is part of it. You know, there's Tim Cook, obviously this is the year that he spoke publicly, wrote publicly about being gay. And I think that really has connected him with Apple's customers in a very different way and made him just very human. And when the leader of one of the biggest companies in the world is seen in that sort of more emotional and human way, I think it changes the perception of the company. And they have more freedom to do things like this. And I suspect that this will be a regular thing, and there'll probably be other stuff. And also, it's good business because Apple makes a boatload of money. It has a boatload of money. And, the best way to get people to not pay so much attention to all the money you've got in offshore accounts, the way in which you make your products, is to do stuff like this.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a great point about Tim Cook seeming more human. I mean, I think there's something about his personality, his guarded nature. He's very, very scripted. And it's hard to imagine him having any kind of personal life at all. And the fact that he came out as homosexual just sort of makes you think, wait a minute, he has a life. He has, a very interesting story. And I do think it's a new Apple. It's a new Microsoft with their new CEO. So there's a lot of newness among the giants out there. So it's great to see Apple moving in that direction, I think. Well, we've been reporting on the antitrust lawsuit over Apple's iPod and iTunes, which recently resulted in a court victory for Apple. As part of that case, the court watched a deposition video of the late Apple CEO and co-founder Steve Jobs, which he recorded several years ago. Yesterday, Apple won another victory when the court granted the company's request to keep the video sealed to prevent it from being seen by the public. And I'm kind of disappointed by this, Lance. I was sort of hoping to see it.
Yeah, so was I. I mean, I understand. I know it was shot in 2011, the year he died, when he was quite ill. And I don't know if I was at an event that year, and I do remember him standing up on stage, and while he was very energetic when he was on stage, the movement about the stage and as he got on and off was quite a different thing. And so I think it's hard for the company to have the world see him in that diminished state. Certainly his wife, who's still out there, has a strong voice and probably made it known that she didn't want it released either. And Apple was certainly going to follow those wishes, and this is my guessing, but I can't imagine she wanted it out there. But I think from a historical perspective, Jobs has had such a major impact on society and culture that we kind of clamor for every bit that we can get of him, every image and every insight. And I think that seeing this would be, by the way, a look at the real Steve Jobs, not somebody who was scripted, not somebody who was making a presentation, but somebody who was talking about why a company did the things it did, why he did the things he did. But we may never see it, and that's a shame.
Yeah, it is. And I miss Steve Jobs greatly. He was one of the most persuasive people ever. And I want to believe that it was Steve Jobs that won this victory for Apple. His reality distortion field may have just changed the whole thing. And that's what I'm going to cling to for now anyway, until I see the video. But it's fascinating to me that so many years after his death, that he still had another shot to persuade a group of people. And Apple won the case. So, you know, maybe he did it again. Well, in other news, Lenovo plans a new smartphone brand that, like Xiaomi and OnePlus, will sell phones online exclusively. In the wake of Lenovo's acquisition of Motorola, which offered an online customization and ordering website called Motomaker, the company's online brand will reportedly be called Fancymaker, and is expected to be introduced April 1st, which makes me think the Fancymaker branding is either a marketing mistake on the part of Lenovo or an elaborate April Fool's prank. Fancy Maker, Lance Ulanoff, what kind of a brand? You know, it's like, what is that?
It was the second choice after Nice Making.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice Making's ridiculous. How about Fancy? It's silly. But, you know, selling these phones online, it's not a huge deal. I mean, yeah. Although, you know, you've got to – I think with phones, what's interesting is that people do like to touch them before they buy them.
Yeah.
They spend a lot of time, for example, in Best Buy, touching all of the phones on display, and then they go home and order online. This happens all the time. So it's a bit of a risk, and the name is probably the biggest risk of all.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll see if they stick to that. And who knows? They still have time to change it, I guess. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Lex3001. Who posted this picture on Twitter, and he listens to TNT with Stitcher on BART, which is the San Francisco Bay Area's commuter train system. There he is on a crowded train looking happy as a clam because he's listening to Tech News Today. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture like this guy, I don't know his real name, of your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTV, #HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it. That's the Tech News Today. Lance Ulanoff. Besides your social media fasting, what are you working on these days? You got any more articles coming out before you take a break?
Yeah, there's a couple. I've got one that's looking at some tech trends to watch, like really big idea tech trends in 2015. That's hopefully going to show up before too long. There's going to be a lot of stuff coming at CES. I'm already talking to people. There's so many unusual, odd products. So that's happening. And and then just about, then I'm going to pull my fingers away from the keyboard for a little while.
Well, like I said before, we're going to miss you on Twitter and on social media generally, but do have a good holiday and good luck getting off social media.
Thank you. Happy holidays to all of you.
All right. Thank you. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, or you can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can follow us on Twitter. Tech News Today TV is our Twitter name. And please send us your thoughts and opinions to TNT@twit.tv or call us at 260-TNT-SHOW. Don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.